I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Mitchell Silk, first Hasidic Jew ever confirmed by the U.S. Senate to a senior federal position, author of the new book, A Seat at the Table. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, and it's still okay to say L'shana Tova Tikatevu V'techa Temo, a good, healthy new Jewish year, and may you be written and sealed in the Book of Life for 5786. It's also time to start saying Chag Sameach for the coming happy holiday of Sukkot that begins tomorrow night. The overwhelming holy day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement we completed last Thursday. I hope all of you have recovered from fasting and the long day of prayer and introspection and repentance that the Day of Atonement entails. But in the Jewish autumn calendar, there is no rest for the weary. The holiday of Sukkot begins 4 days after the last blast of the shofar ends Ne'ilah in Yom Kippur. It's nice to feel like you've done your moral and religious duty and tried to atone for your sins over the past year and are ready for a year of blessing and goodness. Now, at the end of Yom Kippur, after all the fasting and praying is done, it's time to break the fast and celebrate. And on other celebratory festivals like Sukkot, it's customary to sing the Kaddish Shalem, the full Kaddish, to a very upbeat melody. One of the best of the Hasidic Kaddish versions, first notated by Yanki Gottlieb in the 19th century, by the way, little obscure fact for you, is this one. It's fun and bouncy and sung with emphasis by an old friend, cantor David Propus.
Yitadav yitadash mei rabba Ve'yolma divrachirutei ve'yamniche makutei Ve'chayechol ve'yom echon Ve'chayei lechol beit Yisrael Bagala uvizman kariv Ve'yimeru Ishtabach ve'ipoar ve'idromam ve'itnasei ve'itadar ve'itale ve'italal Shemei dekodesha ve'yela min kol birchata ve'shirata Tushbechata ve'nechemata damiran ve'yolema Shmechata v'nechemata Tamiran b'yolema V'yimru Titkabel tzlatan Uva'otot lechon Yisrael Kodam mavon divishmaya V'yimru v'yimru Ve'imru Yehi shlomo rama min shemaya V'chaim Aleinu Aleinu ve'yal kol Yisrael Ve'imru Ve'imru Ose shalom bimromam Ho'yase shalom Aleinu Aleinu Israel.
was the Hasidic Kaddish for the end of Yom Kippur last Thursday night and the beginning of Sukkot tomorrow night. So now that we're really done with the High Holy Days, it's time to say Chag Sameach u'Moadim L'Simcha, a happy upcoming holiday of Sukkot. This is certainly the holiday season par excellence for Jews, and if the High Holy Days weren't enough ritual and observance for you, the underrated festival of the Feast of Booths, Sukkot or Sukkot, begins tomorrow night, continuing for 8 great days. The correct salutation on Sukkot is, as I've said already, Chag Sameach, which means have a happy holiday. Officially speaking, no Jewish holiday is quite as happy as Sukkot, known as the Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy, in Jewish prayer and tradition. Sukkot is a wonderful festival, particularly well-suited to climates where you can spend most of it outdoors, like here in the Sonoran Desert. On Sukkot, we Jews celebrate the fall harvest, building booths in the backyard, which we decorate with the local produce of fruits and vegetables, demonstrating gratitude to God for the pleasures of good food and the freedom to enjoy it. Sukkot, in Yiddish, Sukkot, also harkens back to the time when our ancestors traipsed about the Sinai wilderness for 40 years, living in temporary huts that they built out of what they had lying around. If you were lost for 40 years, you too would get used to temporary housing. 3,200 years later, we still build these temporary sukkahs to remember our experiences as a people. The basic idea is you construct a temporary tabernacle, that's a fancy word for hut, on your own South 40, out of wood or PVC pipe, metal, plastic sheeting, trellises, pretty much anything you can come up with that you think will last for a week. You cover it in greenery of some kind, or mats, or palm fronds. Most of the roof is covered, but you still must see stars through the spaces in the roof at night. And then you eat food in it and invite friends and family to join you for meals in your lovely little sukkah, your hut, and enjoy the great outdoors during this lovely harvest time of year. Here's a sweet little Yiddish song about a sukkah called Asukkele, recorded by Suki and Ding.
Asukkele, a kleine, vom Breitelach gemeine. Hab ich mir a sickele gemacht, bedeckt dem Dach, mit a bisseles Chach. Sitz ich mir in sickele Bana, bedeckt dem Dach, Bisseles Chag Sitz ich mir in Sikkele Banach A Wind, a Kalten Lust durch die Spalten In die Lechterlech sei löschen sich viel Es is mir achidisch, ich mach mir kidisch, in die Lechterle sei brennen ganz still. Es is mir achidisch, ich mach mir kidisch, in die Lechterle Sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht kan Zeit. Soll dir die Sicke nicht sein Bang. Es ist schon geworden, bald 2000 Sikkele, sie steht noch ganz lang. Es ist schon
That was Asukela for the holiday of Sukkot, a time for Thanksgiving, coming up tomorrow night for 8 days. We'll return in a moment on To Jewish. Our guest this morning, Mitchell Silk, first Hasidic Jew ever confirmed to a senior position in the federal government's executive branch by the Senate, will explain how it happened and just how trade negotiations and tariffs work with a huge American trading partner like China. He's the author of a new book, A Seat at the Table, which he had. Meet him when he joins us in a moment here on To Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Mitchell Silk is the first Hasidic Jew ever to be confirmed by the Senate to a position in the executive branch. He wrote a new book, A Seat at the Table. It's a fascinating story. He's an attorney with extensive financial experience, and he has had quite an interesting career. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
This is not the average career track for a Hasidic Jew. Tell us a little bit about your background.
It's really a very interesting set of twists and turns that ultimately got me what I refer to as the seat at the table. It's, you know, kind of the headline is that a lot of hashkacha, a lot of divine providence, and a lot of hard work on the providence side. It all started when I was a teenager and had to go out to help our family finances through a couple of events themselves of providence. I ended up working in a Chinese restaurant and learning not one but two dialects of Chinese.
This is like a reverse Jewish joke. You realize that?
Yes. Frequently tell the one about Ratner's and the Chinese fellow learning Yiddish.
And he thinks he's learning English. And here you're working in a Chinese restaurant. You're learning Mandarin and Cantonese. Is that fair? Or?
Well, I first learned Cantonese. I became fluent in Cantonese. And it was a rude awakening when I learned that there was actually more than one dialect of quote-unquote Chinese. There are eight dialects. The main one, as I'm sure you'll be aware, is Mandarin, which is spoken by about 96% of the folks, the Chinese in China. Unbeknownst to me, the vast majority, 90-plus percent of the Chinese in America in the 70s and 80s, when I was learning Chinese, came from southeastern China, historical matter of emigration trends, and spoke Cantonese. So the Chinese that I was learning was actually Cantonese. When I learned that I would not really be able to pursue a career in China armed with only Cantonese, I went out and then started to study Mandarin. And as I said, that really defined my career. I ended up focusing on Asian studies undergrad at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and was one of the first few lawyers to focus on trade and investment matters with China and finance matters. And that was a string that ran through the whole of my career in big law on Wall Street. I spent 15 years in New York and 15 years in Asia, and spent a lot of time working on energy and infrastructure projects. And it was the combination of China plus infrastructure that brought me to the attention of President Trump through Secretary Mnuchin, who through his first Undersecretary for International Affairs, David Malpass, who went on to become the president of the World Bank.
It's quite a track. I spent 3 weeks leading services in Shanghai at one point, and I can tell you, it is an extraordinary world. You witnessed a lot of that change. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear what it meant to have a seat at the table, some of the global economic implications of what's been going on with China and the United States, and more from Mitchell Silk's book, A Seat at the Table, when we return in just a moment on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in Catalina Foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established 7 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our terrific Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Join us Friday night at 6:30 p.m. for Shabbat celebration services, always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. Our services are available there and in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access them through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism of Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TOOJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America. According to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
By the way, an early Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, the Zman Simchatenu that's coming up. One of the really interesting concepts in Judaism is the ability to make distinctions. L'havdil ben Kodesh L'chol. We have Havdalah at the end of Shabbat to make a difference between the ordinary and the sacred, between the Sabbath and the days of the week, between light and darkness and so on. Because there's an understanding that it's we who create those differences. Let's talk about that concept a little bit.
Yeah, we touched upon this very briefly at the end of the last session, but L'havdil, to distinguish or to make a difference, is really a central tenet of Judaism, and it's repeated a lot. At Passover time, we talk about the distinction between avdut v'cherut, slavery and freedom, in every sense of the word. We regularly talk about the distinction between or v'choshech, but symbolically as well, light and darkness. As you just said, kodesh l'chol, between like holy times, holy days of the week, holy holidays, and normal everyday, workaday stuff. And we structure a lot of our prayers and a lot of our lives around this concept of l'havdil. And a very good example is the Jewish dietary laws. I mean, in kashrut, you make a huge distinction between dairy and meat. And it's not only that you don't eat a calf boiled in its mother's milk, it's that you have separate pots and pans, separate dishes, separate cutlery. Some people have separate sinks. And the whole principle there is havdalah, a distinction. And that distinction is important because it reminds us of the sanctity of life and how vastly different it is to take the life of an animal and to aid an animal by taking its milk. So to the point that we eat that meat in a completely different set of dishes and cutlery and all that from where we drink the milk. There are just so many examples. I mean, you're a rabbi, you can give us much more. But I think this notion is really more central to Judaism than many people realize. And it's pervasive as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I think two important aspects of that. We do make the distinction. I've always explained, look, the Jewish laws of kashrut, of keeping kosher, they don't have their origins in health, even though some people like to say so. They don't have their origins in animal and a prevention of animal cruelty, although that is an aspect of it. They're really about making a distinction, that is, deciding that the most basic biological act, eating food, should be turned into something sacred, a way of thanking God, turning your very table into a kind of altar to God through this complicated, almost metaphysical approach to something super physical. The idea that we have to make those distinctions, that it's not, the world doesn't make those differences. God doesn't make those differences. We, in partnership with God, make these things special. And there are ways of making things special that therefore elevate them to the holy. That's the Jewish idea, l'havdil, to make that distinction.
Absolutely.
Thank you for highlighting that, Tom. We will talk next week, and Chag Sameach.
Also to you. Thanks.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sukkot is an 8-day festival, and we Jews build a temporary booth and eat meals in it to remember our ancestors' sojourn in the desert at this harvest time. So, A guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. His landlord is so irate, he takes him to court and asks the judge to force the tenant to remove this illegal structure. In court, the judge agrees with the landlord. "I understand you have no permit for this unauthorized hut." "That's true, Your Honor," says the guy, "but it's a religious requirement." "Well, that may be true, but the tabernacle structure must go," declares Judge Feldman. "Mr. Goldberg, I order you to remove it within 10 days. Next case. You see, Sukkot will be over in less time than that, and never mind. And now, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy Sukkot. And now a word of Torah. This week, we read a set of special selections from the Torah in honor of the holiday of Sukkot, which begins Monday night, tomorrow night, and lasts for 8 days. This season is a kind of embarrassment of holiday riches for Jews, and the Torah readings reflect this. Sukkot marks the great fall Thanksgiving festival, the Feast of Tabernacles, or Booths, of course. We're commanded to remember the transitory nature of our ancestors wandering through the wilderness of Sinai, as well as the transitory nature of our own lives. In this season of the fall harvest, when we eat the first and best of the produce of the natural world, we take a full week to demonstrate our gratitude for the necessities that God has given us, food, shelter, and clothing. And in this week's Torah reading, we receive the mitzvah, the commandment of building a sukkah, a temporary tabernacle, a booth or hut outdoors, designed to last just a week, well, actually 8 days, to eat in and even to sleep in for some. We decorate it with the symbols of the harvest, fruits and vegetables, and enjoy a fall harvest festival celebrating the goodness of the world that God has given us. It's a great lesson in appreciating the gifts we've received, appreciating the many good things that we have. Gratitude is an experience few of us can maintain for very long, but it is the essential source of so much that is profoundly religious and profoundly good. May it be so for each of us in this week dedicated to gratitude. But while gratitude and joy are the prevailing themes of the Festival of Sukkot and its Torah readings, there is one special additional reading we include on this festival that is not from the Torah itself, but instead from the latter stages of the Bible, the Ketuvim or writings, Ecclesiastes. Kohelet in Hebrew is the name of Ecclesiastes. The beautiful biblical book chanted on Shabbat Sukkot is perhaps the single most beautiful piece of literature ever. Succinct, poetic, gorgeous, and wise. It includes famous phrases that have become part of our language, including "the sun also rises," "there is nothing new under the sun," "all rivers run to the sea and the sea is not full," "for everything there is a time and season for every purpose under heaven." "The earth returns to the dust that it was, but the spirit returns to God who gave it," and so on. The conclusion of Kohelet of Ecclesiastes is simple and powerful. After a poetic search of wisdom and folly, a survey of everything the world has to offer, the author writes, "The conclusion of the matter, all having been heard, is to revere God, keep the commandments, for that makes the complete human being." As autumn approaches, Kohelet reminds us that so much of what we do is vanity. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity," the book famously begins, and it compels us to realize God is our only true source of meaning and beauty. At this joyous time of year, it is a sobering but truly magnificent reminder of all that really matters. Even, perhaps especially, in seasons of joy and times of gladness, we need to remember that our greatest success comes from our integrity and our beliefs. Chag Sameach u'Moadim L'Simcha. May you be blessed with festivals of faith and joy and seasons of celebration. When we return in a moment on to Jewish, our guest, Mitchell Silk, a Hasidic Jew from Borough Park, who is also a high-level attorney and expert on China, explains how he came to have, as his book is titled, a seat at the table when the U.S. and China were negotiating trade in the first Trump administration. It's a fascinating and unusual story. Hear it from Mitchell Silk when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
A terrorist drove a car into people outside a synagogue in northern England on Yom Kippur last week and then began stabbing them, killing two, wounding three others, in an attack on the holiest day of the Jewish year. Police shot and killed the suspect, according to Great Manchester Police. The attack took place as people gathered at an Orthodox shul on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, holiest day of the year on the Jewish calendar. Anti-Semitics in the UK have soared following Hamas's October 7, 2023 war crimes attack on Israel and Israel's ensuing military campaign in Gaza. That's according to Community Security Trust, an advocacy group for British Jews that works to eliminate anti-Semitism. More than 1,500 incidents were reported in the first half of the year, second highest reported since the record that was set last year. Prime Minister Keir Starmer said he was appalled by the attack. Additional police officers are being deployed at synagogues all across the UK now. Starmer flew home early from a summit of European leaders in Copenhagen, Denmark, chairing a meeting of the government's emergency committee. The fact that this took place on Yom Kippur, holiest day in the Jewish calendar, makes it all the more horrific, Starmer said. In other news, President Donald Trump's announcement of a peace plan in the Israel-Hamas war last week was missing one crucial element. "Now we just have to get Hamas," he said. "Everyone is waiting to see if Hamas will sign on. That includes the families of the 48 hostages who remain in Gaza, 15 to 20 of whom perhaps are still alive and would be freed under the plan after 2 years of brutal captivity to Palestinian terrorists. Hamas, which retains some control in Gaza and orchestrated the war crime atrocity-filled October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, faces strong pressure to agree. A number of Arab and Muslim states, including Hamas backers Qatar and Turkey, have endorsed the 21-point plan. So far, Hamas has said only that it is reviewing the plan. It was said it was formally presented to its negotiators only after Trump's joint press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and that a response would take some days. If Hamas accepts the plan, it will agree to disarm and cede control of Gaza, but its leaders will be allowed to leave Gaza alive, and hundreds of its most sought-after terrorists will be freed from Israeli prisons. If it rejects the deal, Israel will have Trump's backing to continue the offensive in Gaza City and elsewhere in the Gaza Strip. Israel would also have politically isolated Hamas and wound up on the same side of an issue as a vast array of world leaders who have recently sought to pressure the country to abandon the war. In less hopeful news, for the first time ever, more American voters say they sympathize with Palestinians than with Israelis, according to a new poll from the New York Times and Siena University. The poll adds yet another data point to a growing pile, showing a sharp drop in sympathy for Israel since Hamas's October 7, 2023 war crimes attack. In other news, nutjob Elon Musk has intensified his long-running feud with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, calling the Jewish civil rights group a hate group in a post on X, which he owns and renamed from Twitter. "The ADL hates Christians, therefore it is a hate group," Musk wrote. The exchange drew quick amplification from other extremist right-wing figures. U.S. Representative Anna Paulina Luna, a Florida Republican psycho, accused the ADL of intentionally creating a targeted hate campaign against Christians. Provocateur, that's a nice way of saying super nut job, Laura Loomer, a member of Trump's inner circle, went further, urging the ADL be designated as a domestic terror organization. Uh-huh. At issue is the ADL's page on Christian identity, a specific white supremacist theology which portrays Jews as descendants of Satan and has been linked to violent terrorism. The ADL explained that the ideology is anti-Semitic, racist, and unambiguously poisonous, and bears no resemblance to mainstream Christianity. ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt, a former guest of Two Jewish, wrote on X that the suggestion his group is anti-Christian is offensive and wrong. noting that many of our staff members are Christian, many of our supporters are Christian. Musk's outburst is notable. As recently as January, the ADL defended him when he gave a Nazi salute during Donald Trump's inauguration. At the time, the ADL called the gesture awkward, a comment that drew backlash from the Jewish community and the group's left-wing critics. The latest clash adds to a series of Musk attacks on the ADL. In 2023, he endorsed a post alleging Jews were pushing hatred against whites, accusing the ADL of unjustly targeting Western societies. He has threatened to sue the organization for scaring advertisers away from X, and recently demanded it remove Turning Point USA, the group founded by Charlie Kirk, from its database of extremist groups. Kirk's assassination took place the same day as a school shooting in Colorado, which was done by a terrorist gunman whose online activity was flagged by a member of the ADL's Extremism Monitoring Division. So they were right. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Mitchell Silk is the first Hasidic Jew ever to be confirmed by the Senate to a position in the executive branch. He served as, let me see if I get this right, not undersecretary, but tell me the exact title you were first confirmed.
It was the Assistant Secretary for International Markets.
So the Assistant Secretary for International Markets, you came from a high-level, highly paid, I assume highly paid position doing international trade. What did people say when you were offered this job and you took it?
Well, the first big question that I got was when the chief of staff to Secretary Mnuchin reached out. He rang me. I was in my office at my former law firm. My secretary picked up. Her jaw dropped when she heard that the Secretary of the Treasury was on the line for me. I went into my office and shut the door, and the first question that the then chief of staff had for me was in resounding very loud over his speakerphone, why do you want to do this? I think that was his way of testing folks to see if they had the gravitas for the position and everything to come. But, you know, the implicit in that is, why would you want to give up your cushy job, take 5% of your comp from the government? You know, I ended up earning at Treasury 5% of what I 5%. Was earning at the law firm, and leave your family. And it was a good question, but my simple answer is that it was the best job that I ever had in my life. I had very much wanted out of college to be in a position to serve my country. Georgetown School of Foreign Service was a feeder and still is a feeder for the State Department. I decided way back then when I graduated from college that I didn't fancy going in and working my way up the ladder, giving visas out for a couple of years in whatever city and, you know, battling my way up in the State Department. And so my view was, why don't you go out and make a career and a name for yourself in a profession, which is what I did with China Energy and Infrastructure and Finance and Bank Regulation. And then after having practiced in big law for 30 years, my opportunity came and I jumped at it.
So the big issues with China and with trade with China, obviously trade with China has expanded exponentially over the course of your career. That expertise certainly came in handy. There was a major pivot under President Trump in his first term. Tell us about that and what the issues were and how they were addressed.
Well, it's a great question. And I could explain how, pretty simply, how the president ensured that we had an effective seat at the table, as it were.
Good name, by the way. That's, maybe you could call a book by that name. Huh?
There you go. So for probably, certainly during the whole of the Obama administration and perhaps even the last year or two of the Bush administration, our country and particular our policy toward China had really fallen into a position of complacency. I believe that the view was that the Chinese would come around and all we had to do was lead them to it. Truthfully speaking, if we were to look back at it carefully, they were basically slow rolling us and they're continuing to slow roll us. And President Trump inherited some pretty weighty issues that had and continued to have some very significant impacts on our country, on our economy, and on our security. He inherited a multi-hundred billion dollar trade deficit. At one point, it was north of $500 billion. He inherited some very significant issues with the theft of U.S. and other intellectual property in China, a lot of cybersecurity issues, currency manipulation, and he had a very simple position. He put his foot down and he wasn't going to take any more of it. And the way that he got the Chinese to the table was to show them that he meant business by imposing some pretty stiff tariffs. And as if you look at the historical movement of the tariff actions, they kept on going north as the Chinese tried to utilize their delay tactics. And it was finally that we had the opportunity to actually sit down at the table with the Chinese. It took a number of sessions over the course of more than a year for us to settle the phase one trade agreement with China. But by the second round, third round, fourth round, the Chinese understood that we meant business and we were not going to leave the table. We were not going to remove the tariffs until we got a deal that was good for the American people. We delivered that deal in January of 2020. Unfortunately, COVID hit right after that. So we never got to see the actual realization of the benefits that we had negotiated into that agreement. But here we are back at the table again. And in Trump 47, it's been the same strategy and the same tactics. Tariffs have led the way. The only difference is that President Trump came to office with 4 years previously under his belt, understood how exactly systems worked, and out of the corner he came punching with almost on day one tariff actions using his executive authority. And that authority has yielded agreements with around 10 countries, which countries represent almost 70% of the total global trade deficit that we have, that the U.S. had when President Trump came into this present administration. And so the tariffs have worked very effectively as a leverage point to get people to the table. You know, the interesting part now is that in addition to sorting trade imbalance issues, our team is using these negotiations to get more investment into the United States, to onshore more industry, create more jobs, and to create outlets for the sale of U.S. energy abroad. So we're seeing some very good benefits out of the strategy.
You know, if, like me, you're not, unlike you, an expert on international trade law, tariffs sounds like something that's coming back from the 1890s as a history person. How do you respond to that?
Well, perhaps the question that you're getting at is, isn't there a price tag with tariffs?
Right.
Don't consumers bear higher prices? Doesn't it impact on inflation and so on and so forth? So the way that I look at it, quite simply, you know, to break it down to its bare basics, are that, yes, tariffs have an impact macroeconomically. One would look to jobs. One would look to inflation indicators. One would look to investment coming into the United States. And some of those numbers are near term. Some of them are measured in a medium term, and some of them are measured on a long term. And what we have been seeing, interestingly, during the first, let's call it half year of Trump 47, is that there has been a marginal hit on some of the indicators, but by and large, jobs are going well. Certainly, buildup of industrial base and new investment coming into the United States numbers are growing, even in the short term. And so I don't really see in this context the near-term macroeconomic downside of the strategy. But really, I am more focused on the midterm and the long term. And the midterm and the long term is really righting the ship on the trade imbalance, onshoring and bringing back more industrial production to the United States. Through that, bettering the economy and creating more jobs. And the trade programming that we're seeing now through the great team that's negotiating these deals, Jamie Greer, who is the U.S. Trade Representative, Ambassador Greer, who I served with, the great folks at Treasury, some of whom I served with under Secretary Bessent, and the folks at Commerce are doing a great job in delivering deals. And those deals are bringing benefits for American people that will certainly outweigh any short-term macroeconomic impacts on indicators that I referred to a little bit earlier. That's That's my take on it.
I want to get to sort of your personal story, because it's woven all through the book, A Seat at the Table. You're certainly not the first Orthodox Jew to serve in a prominent position in government, but it still brings some complications. Tell us about, you know, any personal adjustments that were required, what the government had to do, what your hosts had to do.
Yeah, so I that's a really, really great question, and I kind of break it down into a couple of compartments. One of them is very personal to me, and it relates to myself and my family. And the other aspect, or maybe two dimensions of that, are how I managed, given the requirements that we have under the Torah relating to kashrus, eating kosher food.
Of course.
And keeping the Sabbath, right? So let me start with family first. I live in Borough Park. It's a part of Brooklyn. It's a neighborhood in Brooklyn. It's one of the most densely populated Hasidic Jewish neighborhoods in the world. It's a wonderfully culturally rich neighborhood. I love living here. My wife grew up here. We've been here for the past 20 years. We have 8 kids. 3 of them are still at home. We made a decision when I was appointed that we did not want to disrupt the kids' education. They were in chedorim and yeshivas here in Borough Park. We wanted to keep them there for continuity purposes, and also because there were no equivalents in Washington. So that meant that every Sunday night, I would have to get on a train and go down to Washington. Every Thursday night, I'd come home. It was a lot of wear and tear on the body. It was a lot of my looking after myself in Washington on my own with a very busy job and a lot of entertaining. But the most critical issue was that I was apart from my wife and kids, and they were here on their own. So that's probably the issue that I would cite as the biggest challenge. Beyond that, I think, you know, on the Torah observance, I would call all of that just logistical. There are very few, for those of you who have been to Washington and sought out kosher food, in my day, there were very, very limited options. I almost uniformly every day prepared my own food, brought it to the office. We bought a house in Washington so that I could have a nice venue to entertain foreign dignitaries, which I did usually about once a week, you know, ministers of states and state and ambassadors. And so that's the way that I overcame food issues. I never had a very challenging Shabbos issue. There was one instance where I did need to go into the building on Pesach. When we first started to implement the CARES Act, there was a critical issue. I was called down. I consulted with my rabbi, who lived down the block from me, and he told me that it was not only permissible, but that it was an obligation for me to go in under the circumstances, which I did. But I rarely had any other issues that conflicted with my Sabbath and holiday observance. You know, there was an instance, for example, that I was traveling on mission with Secretary Mnuchin on a tour to the Middle East, and I had to fly separately on one leg of the flight, not a military air with him, because there were some Shabbos issues. But that really was the worst of it. I think the biggest issue that I could point to was the massive pressure that I bore on my shoulders every waking second that I was on the campus, whether it was in Main Treasury, or, as you know, Main Treasury is adjacent to the White House. It's right. Actually technically a part of the White House campus. So whether it was at Treasury or at the White House or abroad on mission, I felt the weight of the earth on my shoulders, because the folks on this podcast can't see me. They could look up my picture, and if they do, they will see that I'm very not mistakenly Jewish. You know, I've got a lot of facial hair. I wear a yarmulke. I've got a black hat. I wear a black suit, a white shirt, and a tie every day of the week. And unless you think that I'm Mormon, then there's no mistaking me for...
No, they're not. It's not a short sleeve white shirt. You're definitely a Hasidic Jew. There's no doubt.
Yeah, so I wore that uniform into Treasury every day, into the White House, past Secret Service, in the halls, all the time. And more or less, depending on other people's perceptions and understanding of what it meant to be a Jew, people would look at me in any circumstance, whether it was just walking or sitting in the Situation Room at the White House dealing with a high-level national security issue, and looking at my every movement, my listening to my every word. And I felt the massive pressure of the world on my shoulders, because I knew that any reflection of mine and every reflection of mine was the difference between a Kiddush Hashem and a Chilul Hashem, the difference between sanctifying God's name and creating a good impression, or the opposite.
You know, I think that's something all of us could use a little bit of, is that awareness. By the way, I'm reminded of what the late Senator Joe Lieberman, Alav HaShalom, used to say. I work 24/6 for my country.
Senator Lieberman was a great friend. He wrote a very nice endorsement of my translation of the Kedushas Levi, but he was one of the pioneers, and of course he lived all of it.
He did. And
he was true to it. Great man.
I want to thank Mitchell Silk for a great visit. His book is very entertaining read and interesting. It's called A Seat at the Table. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
The book's available on Amazon. There's plenty of information on the book site itself, and all they need to do is do a quick search on Amazon, and they'll find it.
Thank you so much, and a good year, a healthy year. Gemar Chatima Tova.
Same to you, Rabbi. Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Our guest will be Michael Shapiro, the founder of the pioneering Jewish wedding website, Ketubah.com, and author of Ketubah Renaissance, a beautiful book just published by JPS. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night, services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page, and this week, Tuesday morning, Sukkot services at 10 a.m. Our playout this morning comes from Dudi Knopfler and crew, that's what they're called, for the coming holiday of Sukkot, V'samachta b'chagecha, rejoice in your holiday. My friends, Chag Sameach, Moadim l'simcha, Chagim uzmanim l'sason. May you and your family have a joyous holiday of Sukkot, a fun Feast of Tabernacles, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, a week, we pray profoundly, of justice, gratitude and peace.
Two Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. Ve ho